Chapter 33 Network Attacks. In Chapter 2, How Hackers Hack, the various ways attackers tried to exploit a computing device were discussed. These included physical attacks, zero days, unpatched software, social engineering, password issues, eavesdropping/man-in-the-middle attacks, data leaks, misconfiguration, denial of service, user errors, and malware. All of these attacks can be accomplished on either the computing device itself or the network connecting to the computing device. Types of network attacks. Network attacks can be anywhere along the Open Systems Interconnection, OSI, model. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/OSI_model. The OSI model is a very commonly known and used construct showing the different layers of interconnection along a network and to a networked computing device. The OSI model has 7 abstraction layers: physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. All layers could be applied to a network and its controlling devices, because network devices run applications too, although many could be applied directly on the computing device as well. A physical attack could be any scenario where a network or network equipment is physically accessed, damaged, or stolen. The data link layer often applies to Ethernet bridges, network switches, and protocols and standards at those layers, like a device's MAC address. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/MAC_address. The network layer refers to routing. The transport and session layers refer to upper-layer protocols, and the presentation and application layers are within the device or application. If a network medium is being shared without any other protections, it is always possible for one node on the network to interfere with another node's communications. The following sections explore some popular approaches for network attacks. Eavesdropping. Eavesdropping is unauthorized viewing and/or recording of an otherwise intended private conversation. Although it isn't as successful now, years ago you could plug a network sniffing application into any network and be able to see plain text conversation streams and authentication information. There are many free tools available on the internet that you can install and then click a single button to start capturing plain text passwords. There are other tools that allow you to capture other people's website cookies and take over their sessions. In most cases, it requires no particular expertise, just the ability to run software. Man-in-the-middle attacks. Man-in-the-middle, MIDM, attacks can be accomplished at any layer of the OSI model as well. A MIDM attack breaks into an unauthorized communication stream and pretends to be an authorized party to all the other authorized parties. Most of the time, the involved original, legitimate party is impacted and often kicked out of the communication stream. MIDM attacks are done for all the same reasons as eavesdropping, including to view and steal private data. However, they can also manipulate the communication stream to change communications and data, like changing a yes to a no when someone asks a question, or misdirecting one or more listening parties to an unauthorized location. Today, many network protocols and applications have protection against MIDM attacks, but sometimes they aren't always turned on by default, often because of performance and interoperability concerns. For example, the Open DNS SEC standard was created in 2004 to prevent DNS spoofing attacks. But more than a decade later, fewer than 1% of the DNS servers in the world run it. Distributed denial of service attacks. Distributed denial of service, DDoS, attacks are arguably the most common and easily the largest volume of attacks on the internet. On any given day, there are terabytes of data being sent to interrupt legitimate sites and services on the internet. DDoS attacks can attack at any layer of the OSI model. Network attack defenses. There are many defenses against network attacks, including the ones discussed in the following sections. Domain isolation. Domain isolation means creating a secure border between authorized and unauthorized network traffic. This can be accomplished using a variety of tools and methods, including firewalls, both network-based and host-based, virtual private network connections, IPsec, routers, software-defined networks, and other types of switching fabrics. If a network attack can't reach your device or network, it's not going to be able to hurt you normally. There are edge cases like when a DDoS attack attacks an upstream or downstream network dependency, which in turn impacts the intended target anyway. But domain isolation can only help. Virtual private networks. One of the best things any device can do when on an open shared network service is to use a virtual private network, VPN. VPNs can be accomplished using software, hardware, or a combination of the two. At the very least, they encrypt all the traffic between the sender and at least the first node of their intended receiver, if not the entire transmission path. VPNs aren't perfect. For example, a DDoS attack can interrupt them. Use secure protocols and applications. Nothing beats a secure protocol and application that includes defenses against known threats. Users should use secure protocols and applications when they are offered, such as SCP and SSH, and avoid knowingly using insecure protocols such as FTP and Telnet. Also, no application should store plaintext logon credentials on disk or in memory, or transfer them across a network. Network intrusion detection. Network attacks can be detected by network sniffers manually, or by looking for predefined patterns of maliciousness. When network maliciousness is detected, it can be dropped or an actionable alert can be created. Network protocol analyzers, such as network sniffers, are a great way to capture and decode network anomalies. Sniffers allow manual analysis, and many include automated methods too. Many firewalls contain network intrusion detection features as well. Anti-DDoS defenses. You can defend against distributed denial of service, DDoS, attacks by hardening network equipment, allocating more bandwidth on the fly, and utilizing specialized anti-DDoS services. Dozens of anti-DDoS services exist today, and they can help protect a company's assets against very large DDoS attacks. The only issue is that they can be very expensive, and every now and then it is an anti-DDoS service vendor causing the problem in the first place. Unfortunately, there are a number of unethical competitors that will do anything to get a customer's business. If you are considering using an anti-DDoS service, do your research to make sure you only go with a legitimate, unquestionably ethical firm. Visit secure websites and use secure services. Many network attacks, like easy-to-steal website cookies and authentication tokens, only occur because the website or service is not using the Secure Development Lifecycle, SDL, in their programming. A properly coded website or service, appropriately threat-modeled and using SDL to close known vulnerabilities, will be more resistant to network attacks than ones that do not. Unfortunately, it's difficult for the average web surfer to know whether the website they are visiting or the web service they are using is following secure practices. Some websites contain security attestations from well-known, trusted security vendors, and if verified as legitimate, should give the casual user some additional level of comfort. Network attacks are a daily occurrence on the internet, and some of them have caused huge damages for their victims. There are many network attack defenses that users and companies can avail themselves of to lower the risk of attack. The next chapter will profile Laura Chappell, one of the world's best network analyzers. Chapter 34. Profile. Laura Chappell. Scientists say that if we ever meet an alien civilization, the likely language used to communicate will be math, because math is the only truly universal language that is likely to be understood by advanced civilizations. To understand what is going on with a networked computer, the only true way to understand it is to sniff the network. No one does that better than Laura Chappell. She is like Dr. Louise Banks, played by Amy Adams, in the 2016 movie Arrival, or Dr. Ellie Arroway, played by Jodie Foster in the 1997 movie Contact. She's very intelligent, focused, especially good at what she does, and respected by her peers. Her classes and presentations are always well-attended and well-ranked by participants. I first met her over 20 years ago when she was teaching a network sniffer class to a local IT group in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Being a woman in IT was a rarity at the time, and Chappell was used to IT guys hitting on her by trying to show how much they thought they knew about network packet sniffing. She ended her introduction speech to our group by saying, "If you think you're going to come up here and impress me by trying to alpha male me with your knowledge of network packet sniffing, don't waste your time. I know more than you do." The crowd loved it. Then she proved she was right, and we became lifelong fans. She has used most network packet sniffers, although her current favorite is the very popular Wireshark, wireshark.com, which comes in both free and commercial versions. I asked Chappell how she got interested in network packet analysis, and she replied, "Back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, I worked for Novell, the powerhouse in network operating systems at the time. I was a member of Novell Technology Institute, a geeky team that researched, wrote, and lectured on all the hot networking technology at the time. When Ray Norda, the CEO of Novell, purchased XLN Corporation in 1989, I was fortunate to sit in on a presentation of the XLN LANalyzer. Watching this early network analyzer tool tap into our Novell network and delve into Novell's request-reply communications and pop up usernames and passwords on the overhead, I was hooked. I said to myself and everyone around me who would listen, I want to do that the rest of my life. Geez, here I am all these years later still listening in on network communications." I asked Chappell how she got into computer security. She said, "I first entered the arena of network forensics quite by accident. In 1993, I started my company and spent most of my time performing on-site analysis of various corporate networks. Back then, companies were solely interested in troubleshooting, optimization, and capacity planning. They never called me in to talk security at that time. Over the years, however, I would tap into a company's infrastructure only to find tremendous security issues screaming across the network. While keeping an eye on the primary goals set by the customers, I had to start bringing up the issue of security to my customers. I was seeing some packets and communications that just shouldn't be on their networks. There were quite a few instances where I felt poor network performance was the least of their worries. They were being robbed blind right under their noses or across the wires. It became very apparent that I needed to weave security analysis into my network analysis tasks. The world of network forensics came to the forefront. Here are a couple of general examples. In the midst of doing an on-site analysis of a customer's poorly performing network, I witnessed a sudden stream of rapid-fire traffic headed towards the egress point of the network. It was coming from a system that should have been relatively quiet at the time, since no one was logged onto that machine. Taking a closer look at the stream of traffic, I noticed there were a lot of dollar signs and dollar amounts in that stream. After reassembling the stream, I realized I had the complete payroll of the company in my hands. During an on-site analysis at a hospital, It appeared students from a major university were accessing the prescription database system, a system that contained not only the names, addresses, and social security numbers of patients, but complete details on the various medications prescribed to them and why. This on-site was designed as a live analysis session to identify the cause of slow login processes. Once the suspicious traffic was detected, everything changed. It became a training session on malicious traffic detection. And the rest is history. I asked Chapel what most interests her in computer security right now. She said, "This is a big question. There are so many fascinating areas in network forensics. The top two for me right now are catching automated background processes, lots of phone home stuff, as they send confidential and personal information out unbeknownst to the users, and teaching folks to customize Wireshark to quickly detect the most common symptoms of network reconnaissance and attack. The Wireshark customization project is a hot topic for me. Building a Wireshark profile that can quickly alert a forensic analyst is a great feature. Teaching folks how to use Wireshark as a network forensics tool is tremendously fun." I asked her what the biggest problem in computer security is. She said, "Coming from a network forensic standpoint, I'd have to say that not enough companies understand how to integrate security through the various departments of the organization. I will often find that the folks who install software on the clients are not encouraged to learn network security. They just install the software and that's it. They don't do a baseline of the traffic to or from the newly minted system. They don't realize what normal traffic is, and so they can't spot the abnormal traffic. They certainly aren't given access to an IDS system to run the trace files through. It would be a blessing if the security folks at the companies would do some internal cross-training on how systems get breached and how to prevent future problems. I know these folks are busy, but they need to spread the knowledge through other departments." Finally, I asked what she recommended that people interested in computer security as careers do. She replied, "First, learn Wireshark, of course." Just kidding. Well, actually, I'm not kidding. Wireshark is a perfect tool to use when you really want to understand how the network works, and it's free. It is ranked number one in security tools over at sectools.org for a reason. Seriously, it's a lot more interesting to watch a TCP handshake than read about it in an RFC. Secondly, learn TCP/IP really, really, really well. Take the time to capture your own traffic while you connect to a web server, send email, upload a file using FTP, etc. As you are learning how the protocols work, watch the protocols using Wireshark. Watch the TCP handshake, the request-reply nature of many applications, the connection teardown process, and more. Thirdly, put together a simple attack lab. The computers don't need to be big or fancy, just tie a few together with a switch and grab some of the free scanning/penetration testing tools available today. Capture and analyze the traffic as you launch attacks on your other systems. Most of us are visual learners. Being able to see an idle scan is way more interesting than just reading about it. And network security is like a two-sided coin. You need to get a feel for how various attacks work in order to know how to defend against them. It's a game. Playing problem-solving games is a great way to prime your brain for networking and security analysis. Laura Chapel is a woman who found her niche in the network packet-sniffing world, became a worldwide expert, and more than 20 years later is still the best at what she does. For more information on Laura Chapel, for information about Laura Chapel, check out these resources. Chapel University, chapelu.com/. Laura Chapel's LinkedIn profile, linkedin.com/in/chapellaura. Laura Chapel on Twitter, twitter.com/laurachapel. In Laura's lab blog, dated material but still relevant, laura-chapel.blogspot.com/. Chapter 35. IoT Hacking. The world of computers is no longer just computers. It's cars, houses, televisions, refrigerators, toasters, glasses, wristwatches, sneakers, lights, baby monitors, medical devices, and almost any other object that some salesman thinks will appeal to buyers more if it had a computer or sensor in it. Most of these items are connected to the Internet and have an Internet Protocol, IP, address. It's known as the Internet of Things, IoT. Unfortunately, many, if not most, IoT devices are very insecure and can be successfully hacked, some quite easily. How do hackers hack IoT? The same way they do regular computers, by picking one or more vulnerabilities along the Open Systems Interconnection, OSI, model layers, Physical, Data Link, Network, Transport, Session, Presentation, and Application. The only difference is that the IoT device may not use traditional hardware or a well-known operating system, or it might not even have a traditional operating system at all. Hackers have to learn as much as they can about the device, research its components and operations, and look for vulnerabilities. For example, suppose a hacker wants to see if they can hack an IoT toaster. The first order of business is to get one and study all the accompanying documentation. They then attempt to determine how it connects to a network and what it sends over the network by enabling a network sniffer and turning on the device. You can learn an incredible amount about a device by listening to what it does or tries when it starts up. They might port scan it, looking for listening ports and trying to enumerate what operating system and services are running. If there is an admin console, they try to connect to it. They try to find out what language the device's code was written in and look for application programming interfaces, APIs. Physical hacking is also a common method of IoT hacking. Hackers take the device apart and see what components it has, noting individual chips and chip numbers. Most devices use common chips, and those common chips are often well documented. Sometimes the chip's vulnerabilities are well known and can be similarly exploited across a range of devices. Hardware hackers cross wires, join chip pins, and even create their own custom chips to get around the device's authentication and access control blockers. They pay special attention looking for input and output ports, and see whether they can connect some sort of debugger to the device. They use man-in-the-middle, MIDM, attacks on communications to try to see information being transmitted and whether they can change those values and what happens. They often share the information they learn in general IoT forums or even device-specific IoT forums. They even create virtual groups dedicated to a particular device, synergizing the expertise of the different members. Here are some examples of publicly shared IoT hacks that make interesting reading. blog.avast.com/2015/11/11/the-anatomy-of-and-iot-hack/ rapid7.com/docs/hacking-iot-a-case-study-on-baby-monitor-exposures-and-vulnerabilities.pdf securelist.com/analysis/publications/66207/iot-how-i-hacked-my-home/ resources.infosecinstitute.com/hardware-hacking-iot-devices-offensive-iot-exploitation/ In general, if you can penetration test regular computers, you can penetration test IoT devices. Except IoT devices sometimes take a bit more creativity and research, especially if you aren't familiar with the operating system or chips. But not only can they be hacked, they are far more likely to be hackable because most IoT vendors don't understand the risk and don't allocate enough defensive resources, at least for now. IoT defenses. It's not like plenty of people aren't working on better securing IoT devices. Most vendors at least think they are addressing it appropriately. Dozens of independent groups like the IoT Village, iotvillage.org/, are working to help vendors better secure their devices. Unfortunately, hacker forums like San Francisco IoT Hacking Meetup, meetup.com/san-francisco-iot-hacking-meetup/, are just as active and are having more success. When an IoT vendor tells you that their device is very secure, they are probably wrong. Most likely very wrong. So what can an IoT vendor do to better secure their device? Well, treat it like you are defending a regular computer. Threat model the device from the very beginning, and make sure the programming includes Security Design Lifecycle, SDL, considerations from the very start to the end of the product's life. Make sure the device uses the most up-to-date software with the latest patches applied, and make the device self-updating. Remove any unnecessary software, services, and scripts. Close any unneeded ports. Use good cryptography in a reliable way. Ensure customer privacy. Don't collect information you don't need. Securely store customer information you do need. Require strong authentication to access and conduct multiple penetration tests during the product's creation and beta testing. Offer bug bounties. Don't punish hackers for reporting bugs. Essentially, take all the computer security lessons learned in the world of computers over multiple decades and apply them to IoT devices. Unfortunately, most IoT vendors aren't doing this, and we are probably doomed to have decades of very hacked IoT devices. The next chapter profiles Dr. Charlie Miller, who is considered one of the world's best car hackers. Chapter 36. Profile. Dr. Charlie Miller. Most people who recognize Dr. Charlie Miller's name and his work know him as part of a hacker duo who can completely remotely control your car like a kid's toy. For a few years, if you saw a news report about hackers making a car or Jeep suddenly speed up or even run off the road remotely, it involved Dr. Miller. A Wired magazine author described his experiences, wired.com/2015/07/hackers-remotely-kill-jeep-highway/, with Dr. Miller and his partner in crime, Chris Valasek. Miller and Valasek wrote a detailed white paper called Adventures in Automotive Networks and Control Units, ilmatics.com/car_hacking.pdf, that describes how many of a car's components, critical and non-critical, could be controlled, including the emergency brake, air conditioning, indicator lights, transmission, entertainment systems, brakes, and even steering. For many of us, this paper was the most insight we had into how a car's network of computer systems worked and communicated. In later iterations, they figured out how to do it remotely. It was car hacking nirvana. They even released their custom tools to help make car hacking easier for others. The idea that hackers could remotely control your car wasn't completely shocking, but seeing two guys do it from their laptop 10 miles away as cameras recorded the action brought home the potential threat in a way that theories on a paper just cannot. Dr. Miller didn't need to actively promote the idea that these techniques in the wrong hands could be used to cause accidents and fatalities. Up until Dr. Miller's frequent public disclosures, the car companies hadn't really done a lot to prevent car hacking maliciousness. Security by obscurity was the biggest protection. Miller and Valasek's research and adventures changed all of that. Car manufacturers began to take notice of all the adverse publicity, and began to take car computer security more seriously. There were even rumors that the testers might be sued by the big car companies in an effort to stymie additional research and disclosures. When I interviewed Dr. Miller, he assured me that he and the others he worked with were never sued or even threatened to be sued. Anyone can be sued, but we were very professional. It's a credit to them and us. They did ask us not to show certain details in one of our future presentations, but we did anyway, and no one sued. This is not to say that the car companies loved what he was doing. Despite Dr. Miller doing some of best public research in car hacking, he was never once invited to give a talk about his findings, private or otherwise, to a car company. And once during a conference when he asked the car companies about more future transparency to help car hackers find and eradicate more bugs, the result was a loud, resounding no. For reasons that sadly tend to repeat themselves over and over in different industries, the very companies that could have benefited the most from their research simply saw them as irritants, if not outright enemies. Luckily, times have changed, and Dr. Miller is working for Uber, one assumes, to better secure their future autonomous self-driving cars. I first met Dr. Miller nearly a decade ago when he was trying to become a high-paid professional bug finder. He held a bachelor's in mathematics from Northeast Missouri State University, now Truman State University, and a mathematics PhD from the University of Notre Dame. Although he is all right with you calling him doctor, you're more likely to see Dr. Miller goofing off in public spaces filled with lots of people, wearing Elton John-style sunglasses, and using physical comedy to make friends. If you thought about what a car-hacking PhD-holding professional might look and act like, it's probably not Charlie Miller. Prior to his current employment, he spent 5 years working for the National Security Agency, NSA, 3 years at Twitter, and further years consulting and at various companies. Dr. Miller's background and love of mathematics made him interested in cryptography, and the combination of the two made him interesting to the NSA. For those that don't know, the NSA, nsa.gov/, is the United States' foremost encryption-decryption agency, if not the world leader. The halls of the NSA are full of the brightest cryptographers our universities have to offer, which is how Dr. Miller ended up there. I asked Dr. Miller how he became a broader computer security person and professional car hacker, and this is what he said. Prior to the NSA, I never thought I could do it, computer security. I didn't study it. The NSA hired me as a cryptographer, and I thought that was my field. At the NSA, you're expected to move around to different offices, i.e. departments, every 6 months to get exposed to a broad range of technologies that the NSA is interested in. You're supposed to choose different topics, but I sort of tricked them into training me in just computer security, and mostly not about cryptography. Other computer security topics seemed so much more interesting than the crypto stuff. I would trick my supervisors into thinking each office was a completely different new topic, but instead they were fairly concentrated on a few more narrow computer security topics. After 3 years, I had been exposed to a lot of cool computer security stuff. I was lucky to be in a place where I was expected to learn and to get paid for it. I asked Dr. Miller how he got interested in hacking cars. He said, "I'd been hacking phones and computers for a long time, but showing the hacking of a computer or phone to regular people just didn't readily elicit understanding and excitement. But people understand a steering wheel turning by itself or a brake applying on its own. It was a hack that I didn't have to promote or sell. It promoted itself and was accessible to ordinary people. We weren't even the first people to hack cars. Others did it first, but we built upon what they discovered and wanted to exploit the limits of where it could take us." Early on, Dr. Miller made quite a name for himself by winning several Pwn2Own hacking contests in only minutes. Pwn2Own, n.wikipedia.org/wiki/Pwn2Own, was a conference based in Vancouver, Canada. It was focused on giving cash and other prizes to anyone who could hack different operating systems and software that were not previously publicly known to have a bug. Each successfully demonstrated hack was a new zero day, which is coveted in the hacker world and is worried about the most by vendors. For a few years, the biggest highlight of the Pwn2Own contest was Dr. Miller showing up and within less than a few minutes using his exploits to walk away with one or more grand prizes. He did this so much that eventually the contest became known as the place where everyone's product would fall within a few minutes after Dr. Miller or one of his competitors sat down. For a few years, this is what Dr. Miller's name was synonymous with, not hacking cars. It was because of his success with hacking some of the most popular operating systems, browsers, and devices at will that people paid more attention when he started talking about hacking cars. His reputation preceded him. We knew that he knew what he was talking about and was probably going to be successful. The secret to Dr. Miller's early hacking success was due to fuzzing. There are plenty of ways to find software errors. You can manually test the software by trying all combinations of operations and manually changing the inputs to see what happens. You can statically analyze the code using source code review software, or by manually reviewing source code that looks for predefined coding errors. Or you can accidentally stumble upon a bug while using the program in a normal way. For decades, those three traditional methods were the way most exploitable bugs were discovered. Starting in the late 1990s, fuzz testing became an incredible source of bugs, and any software developer's program will likely be doomed to multiple zero days if they don't fuzz test their own programs before they release them. With fuzz testing, another software program, the fuzzer, automates the process of injecting all sorts of different inputs, usually unexpected by the programmer or programming language in some way. For example, being extra long, containing random control characters, containing reserved coding words, and so on, into an active version of the target program, looking to cause an error. Each error found is then expected, either by the fuzz testing program or manually by a human, to see if the error condition can be used to exploit the program or underlying operating system. Here's how Dr. Miller describes his fuzzing successes. I learned about fuzzing at the NSA. I liked fuzzing because it found bugs quicker and is really easy to do. I'd turn on the fuzzer, go watch TV, then to sleep, wake up, and look at the findings. Around 2010 at the Black Hat Conference, blackhat.com/, I did live fuzzing on a stage against some other guys in a contest, somewhat modeled after the Iron Chef TV show, to find bugs. They used a static analyzer and I used a fuzzer. It took me a few minutes to get my fuzzer working, but then I literally kicked up my feet on stage and after an hour went by, I won. Note: if you're interested in using fuzz testing software, there are lots of free and commercial products available. Microsoft even offers a decent fuzz tester for free at microsoft.com/n-us/springfield/. I asked Dr. Miller why his earliest exploits were mostly targeted at Apple products. He said, back then, Apple didn't have a lot of computer security protections, especially memory protections in their code, and they didn't do their own fuzz testing. I did it for them and found lots of bugs that I could use in Pwn2Own and other findings. Microsoft and Microsoft Windows did fuzz testing, and their programs have built-in memory protections. I wasn't targeting Apple just to find bugs in Apple and make a point. They were just easier to find, and I like hacking easier. In 2007, he was the first person known to remotely hack an iPhone. And he remotely hacked an Android phone on the day it came out in 2008. Later in 2008, Dr. Miller found a zero day in a MacBook Air's Safari browser and won $10,000. In 2009 and 2010, he cracked Apple's Safari browser again and he continued successfully hacking iPhones. In 2011, he found iOS security holes in iPad and iPhone devices. He essentially showed how an approved Apple app could maliciously steal information or otherwise hack Apple device owners. He created a demonstration program that he placed in the Apple App Store. At this point, Dr. Miller's bug-finding exploits evoked the wrath of Apple. They accused him of violating the terms of his Apple's developer agreement, which was technically accurate, and took away his right to develop and publish Apple software. He told me of the incident. They said they were taking my Apple developer ID away for a year. After I reapplied for reinstatement, it wasn't returned. I still don't have an Apple developer ID to this day. Much of the observing world thought Apple learned the wrong lesson and should have embraced Dr. Miller and his bug hunting by paying or hiring him. When I first met Dr. Miller, he was desperately trying to get a great-paying job finding bugs. At the time, very few people made a real living that way. Most people, like Dr. Miller, didn't get paid at all. There were very few bug bounty programs offered by vendors in the ubiquitous way there are today. In fact, the only people getting paid large sums of money for new zero days were malicious hackers, often paid by bad guys and criminal groups. Occasionally, white hats could sell their bugs to legitimate companies who paid for bugs and then redistributed them to the highest bidder or to the originating vendor so they could examine the bug and fix it. That still goes on today. But Dr. Miller was looking for Apple, Microsoft, or some other company to see the value of his excitement and expertise. For the most part, it didn't come to pass, at least the way he initially had hoped it would. But ultimately, it did lead to his high-profile jobs at Twitter and Uber. Along the way, he brought to the forefront the need for professional bug finders to get reimbursed for their efforts. He wasn't the leading advocate, but he was a very vocal part of it. He even started the No More Free Bugs campaign. Today, nearly every big software developer has a cash-based bug bounty program, and good bug finders can find full-time, good-paying, legitimate jobs. I asked Dr. Miller about the frustration of those days when he was having to chase consultant work instead of finding a full-time job commensurate with his expertise and talent. He said, "I ended up being a traveling consultant, and at the beginning of your career, it's a good thing. It exposes you to lots of companies, their problems, and cultures. I only got paid one time for finding a bug in 2007 for a bug I found outside of Pwn to Own. I quickly found that I liked talking at conferences even more than getting paid. It was more important for me to talk about, to share it with people, than getting paid and maybe having to be silent." If you have attended any of his presentations or conferences, it's obvious that Dr. Miller loves to have fun, entertain, and teach audiences. It's clear he is also in it for the intellectual curiosity as much as the fun and the money. If history is any gauge, once he has mastered something, he moves on to the next field, to another target. He told me, "Once I find five bugs in something, it becomes less interesting and I move on." Along the way, he has found other security vulnerabilities in fields such as near-field communication, NFC. He has also published 3 books, amazon.com/charlie-miller/e/b0085nz1ps/, that cover Mac hacking, iOS hacking, and fuzz testing. I finished my interview with Dr. Miller with one last question. Did he think that cars would be fairly secure anytime soon? He replied, "Cars aren't different than computers, and we still don't know how to perfectly secure computers. Cars are more like attacking networks and networks of computers, since they contain a lot of computers. The thing about cars is the special physical safety issues. It raises the stakes. I may not be able to stop you from attacking a car, but I can mitigate the worst attacks a lot of ways. You may be able to mess with the entertainment system, but if we do our jobs right, we'll stop you from talking with the brakes and other critical systems." True to his early secretive NSA roots, he wouldn't tell me what he is working on at Uber, but you can guess that Uber and all its passengers are going to benefit. For more information on Dr. Charlie Miller. For information about Dr. Charlie Miller, check out these resources. Dr. Charlie Miller on Twitter. twitter.com/0xcharlie. Dr. Charlie Miller's books. amazon.com/charlie-miller/e/B0085NZ1PS/. Adventures in Automotive Networks and Control Units, White Paper. ilmatics.com/car_hacking.pdf. Car Hacking, for Poories, White Paper. ilmatics.com/car_hacking_poories.pdf. A Survey of Remote Automotive Attack Surfaces, White Paper. ilmatics.com/remote%20attack%20surfaces.pdf. Remote Exploitation of an Unaltered Passenger Vehicle, White Paper. ilmatics.com/remote%20car%20hacking.pdf. CAN Message Injection, White Paper. ilmatics.com/CAN%20message%20injection.pdf. Chapter 37. Policy and Strategy. I was a guy who hated policies and procedures. I had no use for paperwork. All it does is slow you down. Or so I thought. After toiling away for decades as a computer security professional, I finally realized that without the appropriate policies and frameworks, nothing will ever get done. Anyone can perfectly secure a few computers and devices. I haven't been exploited in nearly 2 decades. But you absolutely cannot protect more than a few personal devices, and certainly not an entire company's computers, for long without the right paperwork. I've come to appreciate standards, policies, procedures, frameworks, and those who toil to get them right. They really are the true behind-the-scenes heroes, and without them we would not be able to make computers significantly more secure. In this chapter, I break down the paperwork that manages computer security into standards, policies, procedures, frameworks, and laws. Note: you'll also see the terms guidelines and practices frequently used, but I included their traits in the other terms presented here. Standards. Standards are documented minimum norms, conventions, protocols, or requirements. In the computer security world, standards are often communicated as statements such as the following examples. All critical data will be encrypted during transmission and storage. Minimum public key cipher key sizes will be 2048-bit for RSA and Diffie-Hellman and 384-bit for ECC. Passwords will be a minimum of 12 characters long and will contain at least 2 non-alphabetic characters. After 3 bad passwords within a 5-minute period, the logon account will be locked out until reviewed by an administrator. All security patches must be applied within 5 business days after release by the vendor. All computers must be protected by a host-based firewall with deny-by-default inbound rules. A standard is often represented as a policy and further supported by procedures. Standards sometimes become regulations, laws, or requirements that must be followed by every managed device. In the United States, one of the largest standards that must be followed by tens of millions of computers is the United States Government Configuration Baseline, usgcb.nist.gov/. Standards can also be developed by a vendor, like Microsoft's Security Compliance Manager Baselines, technet.microsoft.com/n-us/library/cc677002.aspx. Sometimes the standards become so respected and trusted that they become national or worldwide standards. A great example of this is nearly anything the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, NIST.gov/produces. And many companies spend large sums of money and resources trying to get certified as following the ISO IEC 27001 standards. ISO.org/ISO/home/standards/management-standards/ISO27001.htm. Policies. Policies are documented principles that guide decisions to achieve intended outcomes. Oftentimes, they can be written declarations that could not be easily enforced by other means. An example of this is employees should not reuse their password on any other network. Although a company cannot easily ensure this never happens, just having it written and communicated to employees decreases the chances that a violation will happen. Additionally, if a violation is found, it can more easily result in punishment. Procedures. Procedures are a documented sequence of steps designed to support standards and policies around deployment and operations. Procedures, if followed, will ensure the timely and satisfactory application of those previously stated standards and policies. Procedures can change independently of policies and standards, for example, if a new software program requires different procedures. Frameworks. Creating standards and policies for the entire spectrum of computer security from scratch can be very difficult. Frameworks assist by demonstrating commonly supported standards, policies, formats, and a set of inclusive topics. A great example of a cybersecurity framework is NIST's Cybersecurity Framework, NIST.gov/cyberframework. Regulatory laws. Standards and policies can be codified into legal regulations and laws. For example, companies wishing to process many common credit card types must follow the standards covered in the Payment Card Industry Security Standards Council's Data Security Standard. PCISecurityStandards.org/. Failure to follow the PCI DSS standards could result in suspension of credit card processing use or even legal consequences. Healthcare-related organizations in the United States must follow Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, guidelines. All U.S. publicly traded companies must follow the Sarbanes-Oxley Act requirements, and so on. Global concerns. And for multinational companies, each country can have its own, sometimes conflicting, set of standards and policies. Some countries may highly value personal privacy, while others may legally require no guaranteed personal privacy. One country may require that computer systems used in another country use lesser standards, like the United States crypto export laws require. Global companies have exponentially more compliance issues to be worried about. Systems support. Many companies are under multiple, sometimes conflicting requirements. Trying to abide by one standard can be very difficult. For that reason, an entire ecosystem of companies and tools have been created to assist companies attempting to comply with one or more standards or regulations. Companies usually have dedicated teams and staff members, expensive software programs, and the attention of the CEO. Trying to meet all the compliance standards in a timely manner takes focused staff, the entire IT team, and every employee working toward common compliance goals. Compliance is big business. The consequences of not complying can be regulatory problems, legal procedures, and hackers exploiting known weaknesses. If you just listened to this chapter and wish you had those minutes of your life back because it nearly put you to sleep, know that that used to be me too. It took decades of seeing my incredibly technical, exacting recommendations being misapplied and ignored for me to understand the importance of policymaking and documentation. Without the compliance paperwork, there can be no true computer security. It's just that simple. The next chapter profiles Jing Dijong Chen, whose work focuses on improving international security standards and global cyber governance. Chapter 38. Profile. Jing Dijong Chen. As the previous chapter discussed, you cannot obtain real long-lasting computer security without policies and strategies. Some of the invisible heroes of computer security are the people who drive corporate and global computer security strategies. Jing Dijong Chen, Partner and General Manager, Global Security Strategy, Corporate External and Legal Affairs Division at Microsoft, has devoted her professional life to pushing for better and more global interoperable computer security standards and cyber policy harmonization. She also serves as Vice President of the Trusted Computing Group, TCG, a nonprofit international industry standards organization focusing on security technology innovations. She is a board advisor of the Executive Women's Forum, an organization dedicated to promoting women in the security, privacy, and risk management professions. In addition, Dijong Chen serves as an advisor to the Digital Futures Project of the Woodrow Wilson Center, which champions technology thought leadership to shape public policy development. She received the Women of Influence Award from the Executive Women's Forum in 2014 for her professional contributions to cybersecurity. She holds a master's degree in business administration and a Bachelor of Science degree in computer science. One of the things I noticed right away, when I first interviewed her, was how thoughtful and complete her answers were. She has spent decades successfully fighting for better global public policy and standards, and her experience and expertise shows. The length of her experience is a bit unique for both being a female and an Asian professional, something she readily acknowledges as she actively pushes for more diversity in the computer security field. I asked how she first got involved in computer security. She replied, "I started working for Microsoft in 1992, specifically in research and development, to tackle the challenges of producing Asian versions of Windows 3.1. There was no Chinese version of Windows at the time, and China was on its way to deepening its economic reform and becoming an important world economy. We successfully created the first Japanese, Korean, and Chinese versions of Windows 3.1, supporting double-byte characters. To achieve our vision of democratizing computing with a computer on every desk and in every home, our software needed to be designed with worldwide users in mind. Based on the challenges that we had to face while developing Windows 3.1, we realized that we must change our ways of creating software. We designed an approach to have a single code base, to enable the Unicode standard and separate resources, the language components, from the source code. This was far ahead of many software companies at the time when we released worldwide versions of Windows 95 with simultaneous release of many language versions. We shipped the simplified Chinese version of Windows 95 within 6 months after the US release. That was quite an accomplishment, given the localization involved. To comply with the national language standard, we included over 25,000 Chinese simplified and traditional characters. As you know, China prides itself on being the birthplace of the printing press. But before the availability of commercial operating systems, such as Windows 95, publishing still required manual processes. We worked with Professor Wang Xuan, a pioneer at Founder Group, a Chinese information technology company, to create a Windows-based electronic publishing application with immediate impact to not only China, but also overseas Chinese publishing communities. It was the beginning of China's entry into an electronic publishing era, after thousands of years manual labor. It demonstrated the value of computing to significantly increase human productivity. It was very satisfying to me personally. Then, in 1998, around the beginning of the e-commerce revolution, Microsoft started getting into the internet space. I became a part of our online services division, and you can't be part of internet services and software without security being involved. Within a few years, we had some pretty big challenges as hackers began to use viruses and malware to hurt our customers and the company. The Code Red Worm and SQL Slammer, to name two. All of Microsoft was trying to figure out how we could build more secure and trustworthy software. At the same time, the attacks on 9/11 showed that the industries, such as financial services, that were more prepared for disasters recovered faster. Some of the lessons learned in the previous Y2K preparedness projects paid off for those companies. I saw where security was heading and joined Microsoft's Advanced Policy and Strategy Division under Craig Mundy. I became a part of the newly formed Trustworthy Computing Group, led by Scott Charney, which focused on security, privacy, reliability, and business integrity. I was very fortunate to learn from both very seasoned leaders in technology and cybersecurity. I remember that during those early attacks, markets like Korea and Japan got hit very hard because they were early adopters of our technology and the internet. Millions of users were affected. The governments were concerned. Microsoft had to respond very quickly. I devoted full time to focus on computer security issues and government engagement. I started to conduct outreach and find ways to help create public-private partnerships to minimize risks and address security holistically. We were able to share our expertise and develop solutions to support government and industry partners to build technical response capacity. For example, many police departments in different countries did not have a cyber division and used very old systems. As more cybercrime investigations became a priority, law enforcement needed more experts who can handle incident response and forensic analysis. Microsoft stepped in to support this effort by providing much-needed technical training, including in regions like Southeast Asia. My job is super dynamic, and I am fortunate to work with great coworkers and thinkers who taught me a great deal. Microsoft became a champion in cybersecurity technology and strategy. We began by looking inward and outward and working with partners. In some countries, it was not common at the time for competitors to work together, but we believed cybersecurity was bigger than commercial competition. We shared sensitive security information with antivirus software providers and developed a government security program to support cybersecurity efforts in both developed and developing countries. I eventually started working on hardware-based security solutions in 2008, and since then kept up with my involvement with the Trusted Computing Group, where I got to work with many talented people. I wondered what types of issues she faces and solves as vice president of the Trusted Computing Group, TCG. She gave me an example. You know about TCG's Trusted Platform Module, TPM, chip, which helps to secure computers from the hardware layer on top? Version 1.2 of the TPM worked great, but its design lacked the flexibility to sunset encryption algorithms when weaknesses are found. At the same time, nations began to push for the use of their own algorithms in their security products. TPM 1.2 could not satisfy that requirement, given only a limited set of algorithms were supported. There was a risk of competing by governments at the standards level before any global adoption began. If countries would start down the path of developing non-compatible standards only because of algorithm use, the overall security benefits to the users will be diminished. From an adoption perspective, this would certainly present a challenge of interoperability between the security chips that are based on an international standard and those with a local standard. The TCG made a decision to address this crypto agility issue, among other improvements, with a new TPM 2.0 specification. With contributions from many security experts from different countries, the TPM 2.0 standard was approved at ISO IEC 11889-2015. It is now a unified global standard. This approval was remarkable because it required a consensus among many countries, including the U.S., China, Russia, Japan, France, South Africa, Malaysia, and others. We achieved something remarkable. The new standard offers a much broader security protection, not only for the users of PC desktops, but of the cloud and IoT devices. It was clear to me that DeJung Chen's work decades ago in globalizing Windows 95 paid off when she was helping to develop a globally trusted computing standard and ecosystem. I asked her what she thought was the biggest obstacle to significantly better global computer security. She replied, "Countries have very different belief systems, and that has to be considered when promoting international security standards and best practices. There are issues involving policy and technology. Naturally, the technical experts want to create the best technology, but that's only part of the challenge. There are ecosystem and cyber governance issues to consider. Each country is worried about protecting its cyber sovereignty while competing to build stronger cyber capabilities. You can't just address the technology alone or just leave cybersecurity in the hands of politicians. You have to look for the best solution and balance requirements across a whole spectrum of concerns. And it's getting to be a pretty complex matrix of things that the policymakers and industry leaders need to consider before they take actions. Policy considerations include security and privacy of the internet users, critical infrastructure protection, social and economic stability, and global communications and trade. As more nations release more and more security regulations, the cost of enterprises doing business will rise. Any compliance will involve managing political implications, legal risks, technical design modifications, and business and operational model changes. There are challenges and opportunities, but you can't solve the big shared cybersecurity issues without understanding how countries work and how things are interconnected. If we do it right, perhaps we can achieve the equilibrium required to improve cybersecurity and protect global cyber infrastructure while safeguarding users' privacy, maintaining fair competition, and gradually reducing the cost of doing business in support of global trade. I asked about the lack of women in the IT field. DeJung Chen replied, "Women are rare in the IT field in general, but even more rare in the computer security field. I worked with a large internet company where they aggressively hired women and saw them as the force behind its growth. Even though it has 54% of its workforce being women employees, I did not realize it when I interacted with their security team. There was only one woman who was the liaison, and she was not a security specialist. We could do better as an industry. We need to increase the talent pool in the cybersecurity space, and we need to find ways to attract and retain women in the IT field and promote diversity in computer security. We need everyone's support to achieve that." For more information on Jing DeJong Chen. For information about Jing DeJong Chen, check out these resources. Jing DeJong Chen's Microsoft blog, blogs.microsoft.com/microsoft-secure/author/Jing DeJong Chen/. Jing DeJong Chen's LinkedIn profile, linkedin.com/research/p?orig=SEO_SN_first_name=Jing_last_name=Jung-Chen_SEO_SN. Governments recognize the importance of TPM 2.0 through ISO adoption. Microsoft Secure blog post. blogs.microsoft.com/microsoft-secure/2015/06/29/governments-recognize-the-importance-of-TPM-2-0 /through-iso-adoption/. U.S.-China Cybersecurity Relations, Understanding China's Current Environment, Georgetown Journal of International Affairs, journal.georgetown.edu/u-s-china-cybersecurity-relations-understanding-china's-current-environment/. Spotlight on Cyber V, Data Sovereignty, Cybersecurity, and Challenges for Globalization. Georgetown Journal of International Affairs. journal.georgetown.edu/data-sovereignty-cybersecurity-and-challenges-for-globalization/.